and she is CEO of Success Enterprises, Amy Somerville.
There are many of us who have misconceptions about money, savings, and opportunities for investment. What if I were to tell you that some of the most successful, wealthiest people in the world started with nothing? What if I were to share with you insights and strategies of the world's foremost experts in wealth development? On this episode of Success Magazine Podcast, I am joined by a man who has guided millions around the globe, the one and only Tony Robbins.
So I think the most important thing I learned early on was that we're all equal as souls, but we are not equal in the marketplace. And what makes you superior in the marketplace is by investing in yourself and developing skills.
Hi, I'm Amy Somerville, CEO of Success, and this is the Success Magazine podcast. I'm here with a very, very special guest, a titan in the world of personal and professional development and growth, a beacon of empowerment, a bestseller, someone who is literally, a man who has literally helped millions of people around the world discover their best selves. Tony Robbins.
Well, quite an Robbins.
So honored to have you join us.
Thanks for coming.
Thank you so much.
Appreciate it.
You know, what an important time, a pivotal time for you to join us. Like, no pressure, but we probably need you more than we've ever needed you before. 2023, we'll just say last year, was a lot. A lot for a lot of people. Globally, politically, economically, socially, personally for a lot of people that I know.
And we got an election year this year.
Oh my goodness.
There'll be quite a bit of diversity of discussion. So it's going to be an amazing year.
For sure. Well, so, and in preparing for the next year, how do you, in times of uncertainty, prepare for a strong, a meaningful, successful year ahead?
I think, you know, most people are familiar with the hero's journey. And a lot of times in our life, we don't look at our life in a way that really empowers us. And I think the way to do that is, first of all, don't set New Year's resolutions. That's what most people do. Because by now, I'm sure they were already gone. It's really having a plan for your life. It's really being crystal clear what it is you really want, regardless of the outside. We can't control the external world. We can influence it. But we can absolutely control our internal world, what we think, what we feel, and how we act. And so taking control of that, kind of re-engineering that within yourself, is probably the single most important thing you can do. It's like, I don't care how great your car is, if you want to do a Le Mans 24-hour race, you got to re-engineer it for the new environment. We're in a new environment. There's a race that they do in the Sahara Desert that goes on for days. Oftentimes people die and they're going down into these areas. Well, you could have an incredible Mercedes or Ferrari. It's not going to do well there unless you reorganize it so that it can get the air in the middle of that sand. I mean, in a time of certainty, you've got to condition yourself and kind of build the muscles of certainty, because people think certainty is going to come when they finally have money, and they have plenty of money, and then they discover it's not enough. Mm. And I've interviewed 50 of the smartest financial people in the world, all self-made billionaires. And quite frankly, some of them still are in a place of scarcity. Mm. Money hasn't disappeared for them. They have new stresses, new elements. So it's not money that will give you certainty. And then people think, well, if I have a relationship, I'll be certain. But then they get in a relationship and go, you know, is it the right one? What if they leave me? What if they cheat on me? What if they die?
Right.
You know, I'm going to have kids to have certainty. Oh, really? Kids are uncertainty for the rest of your life.
Those are facts. So
if you want certainty, it's an inside job, not an outside job. And it requires conditioning your mind, conditioning your body to make it happen, to move forward. And, we've been doing this for decades with people. And this last year and a half, 2 years, Stanford did a study because they brought people in who were so depressed. It was the middle of COVID still. People are still stuck at home. And as you probably know, suicides went through the roof. Depression went through the roof. And they sent two doctors, I guess, came on their own to this event I do for 6 days. And they came back and they had no symptoms whatsoever. They got rid of all their drugs. And they said, this is amazing. Do you have the stats on this? You know, because these people are under enormous stress and they're doing better than ever before. And I said, well, they've re-engineered their minds. They have a different way of organizing meaning for themselves. Is this the end or the beginning? You know, are these people, you know, dissing me? Are they challenging me? Are they coaching me? Or are they loving on me right now? Mm. The meanings we create for our life control everything. And we have an invisible system in our brains that most people know what it is. So I said, yeah, I'm not surprised by it. It happens all the time. And they said, well, do you have data on this? And I said, well, I got millions of graduates of the programs. They said, no, I mean like scientific data. I said, no, but if you want to do a study, I'd be happy to. And so they did. And they brought a group in, and I first asked them, I said, when it comes to depression, for example, so many people get uncertain and get depressed because it's like, I don't know what to do. I don't know what's going to happen. What could happen next? That uncertainty anxiety. Freaks them out and creates anxiety. And I said, so what's the best, you know, what's the meta study show on treatments of depression and anxiety? And they said, well, on average, 60% of people, whether they do drugs or cognitive or any form of therapy, 60% don't get better at all. 40% get better and their average improvement is 50%. I said, well, you know, but if they're half as depressed,
it's not good odds. Yes, yeah.
Some people get better, but very few. And they're on these drugs, many of them for the rest of their lives. And he said, I said, you could do better with a placebo. He said, yeah, you might be able to. And I said, well, let's do that. But what's the best result you've ever seen? And they said the best result they'd ever seen was done at Johns Hopkins about 5 years ago. They gave people psilocybin for 30 days and gave them cognitive therapy for 30 days. So magic mushrooms.
Right.
I said, at that point, you should have had a major change in their states. And they said, we did. It was the greatest return they've ever seen in psychiatry. At the end of 6 weeks after the treatment, 54% of the people had no symptoms whatsoever of depression, unheard of. So I said, okay, well, set it up, make the same comparison group as that. We won't do any drugs and let's see what happens. And I'm proud to tell you that when they were done with just 6 days, no drugs, just rewiring their brains, just developing that inner certainty to be able to deal with whatever happens in the world. The numbers were so powerful, they were afraid they were gonna get canceled if they published it. So they sent it out to three different organizations blind. And the answer was 100% of the people after 6 days, 6 weeks later, had no symptoms whatsoever. But better than that, 17% of the people had suicidal ideation, thinking about suicide. Not a single person was there. They followed up 11 months later, they're gonna do 12, but COVID was ending. So they had all the stats up till then. And they found 72% reduction in negative emotion, no depression, 52% increase in positive emotions. So that was published in the Journal of Psychiatry. So I'm telling you these details because I want people to know we're a drug-oriented society. And you and I both know that if you just give somebody a drug, you've not dealt with anything. All you're doing is trying to cover it up, right? And what it really does is make you numb. But when I'm in a large audience, 20, 30,000 people, 10,000 people, I always ask, how many of you know somebody that takes antidepressants and they're still depressed? Yeah. And 80, 90% of the room, you know somebody too.
Yeah.
Well, then why? And on the side, it says create suicidal thoughts in some cases. And the last year, the cover of Newsweek was showing that SSRIs don't even work. Wow. And yet we're still doing it. So there are tools that you can re-engineer yourself, but it comes down to changing the way you perceive the world so that you can find a benefit in anything. I'm not talking about positive thinking. Positive. I've never been a positive thinker. That's what a lot of people believe in. I don't believe in that. I believe in intelligence. And intelligence says see things as they are, but not worse than it is.
Okay.
Most people make it worse than it is because they're afraid of failing. So they come up with a reason why they don't have to even try. And then once you see it as it really is, not worse than it is, then you got to see it better than it is. That's what makes you a leader. You have to have a vision. The Bible says without a vision, people perish. It's true. So we got to have something compelling to move forward. Anybody can deal with a difficult today if they have a compelling tomorrow. Mm. But if you have kids today that are told that the whole world's going to be done in 12 years, we're going to have, you know, environmental disaster. These types of stories have been said since the 70s. It's total BS. But when people hear that, then they're, I don't want to have a child. I don't want to get married. It's absurd. And it's only because we're going through a season called winter. There's emotional seasons that happen every 20 years like clockwork. Springtime, everybody's optimistic. It's easy to build a business. Just like springtime, everything grows easily. Summer, everything gets tested. It's hard. Why isn't it working? Are you going to push through it? So you go from easy to hard to easy again. Fall, where you get to reap everything. And then if you're smart, you hang on to some of it for the next winter to push through it. We're in a season where people see it worse than it is.
Okay.
They make the fear larger than it is. So your first step is get yourself out of the news and shut off your social media that's coming and ringing in your pocket. Because all these things happened before, but now they're right there in your face every second. You know, today my phone buzzes and I glance down to it and it's about somebody I don't even know's father is in the hospital. Like, would I have known that? This is I'm not talking about text, I'm talking about a news flash. It's like constant negativity, and that's what makes us watch. Yeah. Like, why do people go for clickbait? It's because it's one thing. The brain has a negative bias. It's a survival bias. I'm always looking for what could cause me to die, to be hurt, to be injured, to lose respect, whatever. And so we're constantly looking for that, and we get fed. That's why it says in journalism, you know, if it bleeds, it leads. Mm-hmm. So journalists are not bad people. They're good people, but their job is to make money for their shareholders. And the only way to do that is get your attention, because we are not a knowledge society or an information society that died a long time ago. We got too much information. We're starving for wisdom. We're drowning in information, but starving for wisdom. So I think it's an opportunity for you to say, let me cut off those things. Let me focus on what I really want. And let me start with my deepest desires. Every hero's journey starts with, what do I really want now? Mm-hmm. Something disrupts your life, some challenge that happens in society, the world, your personal life. And because of that, things are shaken up and you have to decide, what do I want? Mm-hmm. And then to want that, you have to go on a journey. And on that journey, you're going to face dragons, and you're going to meet some good mentors, and you're going to have uncertainties, and you're going to grow, and you're going to expand. And if you push through, you'll slay the dragons, the ones that are internal, and you'll come back the hero of your own life, and you'll be able to share what you've learned with other people in a meaningful way that is not ego-driven, but truly service-driven. So that's a long answer to the question, how can we prepare ourselves?
You know,
the fastest way to prepare yourself is decide, what do you want for each area of your life?
Okay.
And then secondly, be honest with yourself. Face the truth about what's the gap and what's in the way. The gap meaning, here's where I am versus where I want to be. Instead of just saying, I want to lose some weight or I want to feel better, it's like, how much am I overweight? Tell yourself the truth. And then, why do I have this gap in my relationship, in my business? And there's only five whys. So look at them so you can solve them. Is it fear? So you just don't ever push through. Is it a limiting belief? Like, I've tried everything, all the good ones are gone. You need to get rid of whatever it is. Is it some other emotion like overwhelm or stress or loneliness or depression that's slowing you down? Is it a habit? You get up in the morning and the first thing you do does not put you in a state for your life. Or is there a skill you're missing? Maybe you don't know how to invest. You don't know the skills. So of course it feels overwhelming and impossible. Maybe you don't know how to grow a business and you own one, but you've never really been instructed. You've never really gone through a training to know what to do. And most people start a business, they get all excited. They don't know every aspect. They don't know how to manage their numbers. So if you look at those five things and you face them, then you just need step three is you need a massive action plan. Here's what I'm gonna do right now, not perfectly. And then you need to slay your dragons. You need to do the hard work.
Yeah.
And the rest is easy. But start your year by knowing what I want in each area for my body, my relationship, my finances, and what's gotten in the way and what I'm gonna do different. That'll get you there. How's so that for I a
kind
short
of,
answer?
You know, so I kind of, I was prepared and I still wasn't prepared that I knew I would ask you one question and feel like I just got a mountain of gold nuggets and everything that I need for, you know, empowering myself for the next year and beyond. So thank you for all of that. I'm like, wish I was taking notes. Okay, so Tony, not only have you helped us navigate always uncertainty, but we have been the beneficiaries of your passion for health, for longevity, for giving back to people in need, for discovering the tools for financial freedom. And that is my transition into, we're so excited to hear that you have written the third of your trilogy, and the finance trilogy.
Yes.
Is called The Holy Grail of Investing.
Yes.
Tell us about it.
Ta-da!
Woohoo! Tell us about it, and you know, what moved you to write the book, and why now?
Well, it's interesting. I wrote the first book after 2008 when all hell was breaking loose because there was no one untouched. Mm-hmm. My billionaire clients were touched. My barber client was touched, right? Everybody was scrambling, and some people worse than others. And I knew it was coming, and I knew it was going to go about because I've coached Paul Tudor Jones, one of the top 10 financial traders in history, for 23 years. Mm-hmm. Literally, I talked to him for 3 hours in person about every 3 or 4 months, but I get a report from him virtually daily, and I know what he's doing and how he's doing it. So I've learned an enormous amount about finance. And as much as I knew, I thought when 2008 happened, by 2009, there was no improvements. And by 2010, the people that basically almost destroyed the financial system, their punishment was we gave them more money. It just blew my mind. So I decided I don't have all the answers, but I do have access. Mm-hmm. I have access to the smartest people in the world. So I said, I'm gonna interview 50 of the smartest financial humans on earth, the most successful investors in history. All of them had started with nothing. Everybody a self-made billionaire. And I wanna find out what are the strategies. And they were all different. They all had different ways. Some are value investors, right? Obviously, I like a Warren Buffett. Somebody else are macro traders. But I looked for what the common denominators were. I found out what they were. And I shared those. And I got very excited at what I could do for people. And I wrote this almost 700-page book that people, my billionaire clients, would love anybody else. I wrote the second book because I knew we were going to have a crash. Mm-hmm. I didn't know when. No one knows when. But I needed people to be prepared for it because we had a bull market for so long.
Right.
And I wrote this third book because when I was writing the first two books, I became very good friends with Ray Dalio, who's a total genius. He's the most successful hedge fund manager in history. He manages almost $200 billion in business now. And one of the questions I asked Ray when we first met was, of all the principles that you know, of everything that you've ever come about in your investing career, what's the single most important thing people need to know if they're going to successfully invest? Now, I ask this question of all kinds of people,
yes.
Right? Brilliant, got all kinds of answers. But his is the best, and his was the title of his third book. He said, Tony, I'll tell you the holy grail of investing. Now, before I tell you that, I got to tell you that all the people I talked to had four things in common, even no matter what type of investing. They said number one rule that made them successful is they don't lose money. Now, you know, of course they lose money, but they said that's their obsession. The average investor is trying to make money. Mm-hmm. How can I do well? They don't take care of the downside. And if you have an investment in a stock and it goes down 50%, you don't need 50% to get even. You need 100% to get even, right? And people don't realize that. So these guys are obsessed with that. They're not constantly saying, I'm going to get rich instantly. But then how do they do that is the second principle, and it's called asset allocation. Many people have heard of it. Sounds complex. It simply means if I've got a certain sum of money I'm going to invest each day or each year, each month, whatever, I've got to decide how much of that am I going to put into investments that are low risk. But low risk brings me less return,
right.
But it's kind of like the turtle approach long term. How much will I put in things that may be higher risk, potentially get a higher return or lose? And you can't answer that percentage 50-50 or 90-10 or 80-20 unless you understand what your risk tolerance is, when you need the money. If you're really young, you can take a lot of risk, right? What your cash flow is like. But they have these specific ways. And why I wrote this third book was combined as I started to become obsessed because every single person I talked to said, there's only three ways to be able to increase the pace or success of your investing. One is make better investments, and you're not going to. You're gonna always make bad mistakes. I don't care who you are. Second one is you're gonna have better timing. That's luck. The best people know that. The one that controls all these returns is how you divide up your assets, this asset allocation. And while I was doing this research, I found out that the ultra net worth, high net worth people all have their money managed in a radically different way than the average person. And
okay.
They get much better returns. They have 46% of their money in private equity, okay. Private credit. In other words, instead of the public markets, they have money there too. They have about 27% there, but 47%. And I was struck by this and it started making me looking around. So right around the same time, I'm interviewing Ray Dalio. And by the way, the third principle is called asset, is you want to make sure that you're making investments. We have what they call asymmetrical risk reward. Big words. It just means, how do I take the least amount of risk with the most amount of upside? Most people think that billionaires or people took these giant risks and they just won overnight. And sometimes it may look that way to you. If you see my friend Richard Branson, he risked his life, you know, on balloons and now going into space and on boats and so forth. But if you know Richard, Richard's so successful investing because his whole thing is, what's the downside? What's the downside? People don't see that. He doesn't do it with his life, but he does it with investing. When he first went to go compete with British Airlines and build Virgin Airlines, that's a giant investment. And when he went to do it, your biggest investment are these planes, gigantic Boeing planes. And he negotiated for a year and a half until he got them to agree that he'd buy all these planes, but only if after 1 year, if he was not successful, he could return them all with no loss to him personally. And they agreed. So what does he have? Only upside,
right.
No downside. That's how the
Amazing.
Smartest investors. Now, you can't always get asymmetrical risk reward, but you got to look for it. And the best investors do. And then finally, the fourth thing is diversification, which everybody knows. You can't put all your eggs in one basket.
Right.
Diversify, not just in buying a stock, but different stocks, different environments, different timing, et cetera. So what did I learn from Ray, though? Ray, I agreed with all four of those things. But he said to me, the most important principle of investing, and he called it the holy grail of investing, the title of this book, is if you can find 8 to 12 uncorrelated investments you really believe in, you'll reduce your risk by 80% and you'll increase your upside. So I said, how is that? He goes, well, you understand correlated or uncorrelated for your viewers. I'm sure they do, but just in case, when things are correlated, they move up at the same time and they drop down at the same time. Different levels of correlation. Some are 100%, some are 80%. If they're not correlated, One might be going up, the other might be going down. So traditionally, when people go to a financial planner, the first thing they tell them is, okay, we're going to balance your risk. Let's put whatever, 50%, 60% in the stock market and 40% in bonds. The idea of that is the stocks potentially have a higher upside, and when they come down, the bonds protect mm-hmm. you. But unfortunately, in real tough times like 2020 or 2008, that's not how it worked.
Right.
They all crashed. And then you go to financial planning, goes, gosh, you know, it's really, you know, nobody saw this coming. It happens every time. So there is a better way than that. And what the better ways is to find these 8 to 12 uncorrelated investments or non-correlated investments. And he showed me, he spent years figuring out the numbers and showed me how it's 80% reduction. How'd you like to be invest and have 80% less risk and more upside? And that's pretty magical. But then how do you do that? How do you find 8 to 12 uncorrelated investments? Because even if you say, I'm going to do some stocks, and then I'm going to do, say, some real estate investment trusts, mm-hmm. real estate investment trusts very often have the same tempo of movement. So what that just brought me back to why I wrote this book finally, which is I need to show people what the wealthiest people do, because today a lot of people don't think they're going to get there. So how are you going to get there? If you're compounding your money at 5%, it's going to take you 14 years to double your money. There aren't a lot of 14-year cycles.
Right.
If you can compound your money at 8%, which is what the stock market, or 9%, what the stock market would do, you're compounding every 8 years. If you're compounding at 20%, which is what they do in private equity, or 14.2, the numbers will go through the roof. So let me give you an example. In private equity, private credit, and private real estate, these are the areas where you can find a lot more diversification. There used to be 8,000 stocks. There's only 3,700 now to pick from. More people in the world all trying to get the same stocks, and most of them aren't making money. If you go to the S&P 500, mm-hmm. there's five stocks that are 25% of that entire market.
Right.
That's what they produce. If you go to the Russell 2000, half of them, or about 40% of them, are not making a profit. So people are betting on the future. And there's a limited number. Everybody going after a limited number. When you look at companies that over $100 million in business and sales, 90%, 95% of them are private. So these companies, private equity companies, go invest. Now, how have they done? Over the last 35 years, if there's nothing else I set up in 10, I hope you'll hear this. Over the last 35 years, straight years, on average, people in private equity have outdone all the global markets that you're talking about, public markets. Let me give you a specific example. The S&P 500, everybody's okay. familiar with, right? So over the last 35 years, it's managed 9.2%. That's awesome. You're doubling your money about every 8 years, okay? There's some ups and downs there, but that's the average. It's pretty amazing. But if you took that and you were saying, what's the average, you know, person in private equity? And that was 14.2% over those 35 years.
Wow.
9, 14.2 doesn't sound like much. It's 50% more money each year compounded. Right. So let me tell you what that means. In 35 years, if you put $1 million 35 years ago on the stock market, it's worth $26 million today if you did nothing else with it. If you put $1 million in private equity, it's worth $139 million. It was the same money in the same time period.
Wow.
So, and the people I interviewed for this book are 13 of the biggest people in private equity, private credit, and private real estate, the very best on earth. And virtually all of them are 20% plus per year compounded, some of them for decade after decade after decade. So the speed at which you can move. Now, here's the next problem. The average person does not have access to these investments.
Right.
Right? And so that's why I didn't write this book before.
Okay.
But what pushed me finally over the edge is, like, I would go do this. I took and did my 8 to 12. I found my 12. I did it by going through private equity, private credit. I got exposed to all kinds of great opportunities. But if you know anything about the best investors in the world, they have funds and they sell out like that. They go to all the private, you know, the pension companies. They go to the people that are the wealthiest people in the world. It's kind of like if you wanted one of the brand new custom Ferraris, they're gone. They're all pre-sold, basically. So I was able to get on some of those opportunities, but it was very limited. I was getting very, very frustrated. Two things happened side by side. One is I met a friend of mine who taught me, who was one of Paul Tudor Jones' former partners. He started his own firm. And I was telling about my frustration. I'm getting small amounts of money in these groups. They only allow you so much because everybody wants a piece. And he said to me, Tony, he said, I got some cool news for you. He goes, I'll tell you where I put most of my money. This guy is extremely successful financially. So I'm leaning forward, listening on bated breath. And he says, there's a firm you got to find out in Houston, Texas, called CAZ, C-A-Z. And I said, Houston? I thought he was going to tell me Singapore, London, you know, New York, Connecticut. He goes, no, these guys are off the beaten path. That's why they're the best. He said, they have helped me not just get into funds, the best funds in the world. They own a piece of all these companies, these private equity firms, and they get the 2 and 20 they earn. And when you're a part of it, you're able to buy a piece of the firm itself. I said, wait a second. Instead of trying to get in and get into one fund, I could buy the firm that owns multiple funds and I could be side by side as a partner. He said, yeah. If you're an investor in a fund like that, they call you a limited partner. The owners, the CEO, CFOs, the C-suite, those are people, they're called general partners. You get to be a GP, a general partner. And here's what they're getting. People don't understand. When you give them their money, they're so successful, two things happen. One, they tie your money up for 5 years. So there's less liquidity. But for that, you got to get something, which is higher returns, right? And if you're trying to do that over time, that's probably a smart move. They get 2% of your money every single year, whether they make you money or not, right? On top of that, they make 20% of the upside. So if you look at the Fortune, you know, 400, the richest people in the world, and you say, what industry has the largest number of billionaires? People think it's tech or they think it's real estate. It's financial services and it's not hedge funds. Hedge funds go up and down. It's private equity, it's private credit. And the reason is because if they have a $1 billion fund, that's a small fund. The guys I interviewed have $100 billion funds, to give you an idea. Mm-hmm. A $1 billion fund, they're guaranteed. How'd you like to have a business where you're guaranteed cash flow of $20 million a year for 5 years, $100 million, not bad. And
sign it up, yeah.
And if you grow it, you get 20% of the growth. Well, it's not uncommon for them to grow in 5 years, double it to $1 billion to $2 billion. And guess what? They're going to make 20% of that. So they make $300 million on $1 billion of capital. And like I said, some of these are 20, 30, 50, $100 billion firms. And they have multiples. So I'm no longer competing. I'm side by side as an owner.
Wow.
It is one of the most exciting things I've ever done. So then I was like, I'm doing this. And I got into it. And then I was like, but the average person can't do this. And I've always thought it was insane that the government regulates it so only wealthy people get the best opportunities. And they call it an accredited investor. That's one of them. That's the first level. You have to have $1 million net worth or $200,000 year income to even be able to get into these investments. Supposedly that makes you a sophisticated investor. But I know lots of people that were not sophisticated investors. They made their money by building a business over 20 or 30 years. So they have plenty of money, but they're not sophisticated investors. How unfair is it that only these people get to do it? And finally, this year, last year, and now this year, 2023 is when they started, the House passed the law. We're waiting for the Senate. They're going through it now. It was bipartisan. It's the coolest thing in the world. You don't have to have that capital anymore. You have to learn and take a test.
Okay.
And if you can pass the test, you get access to these same type of investments that were only available to people before there were accredited investors, or there's another one called qualified purchaser, which means you have to have $10 million of investable capital. So that opportunity is why I wrote the book. It's like, I want people to know what is really possible. I want people to see how they can have less risk and greater upside. That does not mean this is the only thing to do. I still have, you know, public investments as well. My asset allocation is spread out. But this is an area where 5% of the general public has things in private investments, whereas 47% of the investments in people that are already wealthy. So if you want to get there, why not use what got them more wealthy more quickly? And that's the holy grail.
That's unbelievable.
Isn't
it amazing? It is amazing. And congratulations.
Thank you.
And I'm going to say congratulations to us. I want to thank you for something because that has been your trajectory. What I know of you is that you do tap into the access to the elite, to the most experienced, to the people who are, you know, the top 1%. You take and gather information, you package it up, you know, whether it's finance or health or what have you, package it up and give it to us normal, everyday, average folk so that we can actually tap into it. So thank you for that.
Well, no, it's my pleasure. I want people to have freedom. I want people to have security. And When you're compounding at 5% and it's taking 14 years versus 20% and it takes you 3.5 years and then you compound again and compound again. Now, you can't get that on everything, obviously, but these types of investments are there. Now, I also want to make clear, these are not as liquid. That's why you need your asset allocation. What am I going to do that's still liquid as well? It's not saying everything should go here, but the mass majority of the capital and most successful people financially have their money here. And that's certainly true for me. And I wanted people to see it as soon as it could be legal like this.
Just under the heading of investing, what would you say to people, maybe even young people, who think when they hear the word investing that there has to be some sort of salary amount or a certain minimum in savings before they can invest?
Well, I think the biggest mistake people make is they don't understand. We all know compounding. We've all heard of the power of compounding, but I don't think most people get connected to what that really means. So a sample I like to give people is if you had two brothers, you know, Bob and Joe, and Bob starts at, you know, 18 years old and decides he's going to put $300 a month aside because he lives at home, which a lot of 18-year-olds do today. And he puts it in the stock market. And then he just does that for, you know, 8 years till he's 27 years old. And the total amount that he's going to put in there over that whole time period is $28,000, $300 a month. And he never invests again. And then his brother Joe, let's call that Joe. Let's say his brother Bob over here goes and he starts at 27 and invests $300 a month for the rest of his life till he's 65. So it's 38 years, not 8 years of investing. Right. And, you know, he's in a place where he's putting $140,000 into it, not $28,000. Who's going to have more money?
Right.
I'm sure you know the answer. It's a setup. But who's going to have more money at the end?
The first guy. Yeah.
Why? Because he started earlier, even though he only did it for 8 years.
Right.
He's going to have 1.8 million and his brother's going to have 1.5 million.
Yeah.
One did it for 8 years. So it's not the illusion people have is I got to make a certain amount of money or I'm going to get rich. You know, yeah. It's like I remember Kim Basinger made a movie that was shot out here years and years ago, you know, 9.5 weeks. And I had a chance to visit with her and everything else. Really brilliant lady. In the 90s, she was one of the most successful actresses in history. She was making $10 million a film. She went bankrupt. How do you get bankrupt doing that? Because making a lot of money is not how it works. It's creating a money machine that keeps building slowly while you sleep,
yeah.
That keeps compounding that does it there. You know, Mike Tyson's a friend of mine, Mike's a crazy guy. He made $500 million in income as a fighter and went bankrupt.
Broke, yeah.
So what you really need is to understand you don't need a lot of money to become wealthy. What you need is a small amount of money that you consistently put aside and you compound. And then ideally compound in environments that are secure and environments where there's significant upside and you have to have the right asset allocation. But when you're younger, you can take more risk. So it's really the example I just gave of Bob and Joe. It's like, I'm going to take a small amount of money even.
Yeah.
And the ideal is 10 or 15%. And then every time you get a raise, take a portion of the raise and add it to it. But taking something that comes off the top that you never see, you have it automated by your bank or automated by your broker, that money is set aside, then you can figure out where to invest it. But you got to train yourself not to see it. There's a gentleman named Theodore Johnson. I read about in my first book. He worked for UPS. He was a driver. Everybody loved him. Like if he was sick, everybody's like, where is he? You know, because he just lifted people. He never made more than $14,000 a year. When he retired, he had $70 million. He gave away $35 million while he was alive on $14,000 a year. How? A friend of his came to him when he was pretty young and said, I'm gonna make sure that you're wealthy. He goes, I'll never be wealthy. I make 14 grand a year. He goes, no, we're gonna put a 20% tax on you. We're gonna take 20% of your money off top because I couldn't live. He goes, you'll adjust, you'll figure it out. And they automated it.
Mm-hmm.
That's all they did. And they put the money in UPS stock.
Set it and forget it, right?
Set it and forget it.
Yeah.
$70 million gave away $35 million a year. So you don't have to be a superstar. The delusion is, especially in our world today with social media, I'm going to get rich quick. The people get rich quick, even athletes who make all this money, most of them later in life don't have any because they haven't figured out how to shift from being, you know, a consumer to an owner.
Yeah.
And that's the biggest shift you have to make. But the answer to your question is you have to come up with a percentage you set aside, and then you need to study what are the best ways to do it. And the reason I wrote these three books, and the other two are number one bestsellers, I'm sure this will hopefully be the same, they're that successful because they show you exactly what to do from day one, starting with nothing to where you want to go. If you're sophisticated, you can start at that level. If you're just beginning, we'll show you exactly what to do.
Can I ask you about a personal question?
Sure.
About starting with nothing?
Yes.
You know, I don't know if you consider yourself a rags to riches story, but it's unparalleled. The stories I've heard of where you came up, how you came up, and where you are today, and that you were giving and investing even when you didn't have the ability to, or most people would think you wouldn't have the ability
yes.
to.
Yes.
Looking back at your journey, what is like one lesson you wish you had learned earlier in life?
Gosh, my investing wasn't starting that early when it came to investing in anything other than real estate. I made my first investments in real estate in 1978 when I was turning 18 and interest rates were 18%.
Right.
And I bought a triplex and tried to make money at 18%.
Right.
It's good luck. I would say one of the things that did work for me investing was investing in people, investing in my own education, and wanting an understanding. You know, Warren Buffett talks about this today. A lot of people are worried about inflation and they say, you know, what are we going to do? And he said, it's really simple. The most important investment you can make is in you. When I interviewed him a decade ago or so, I said, what's the most important investment you ever made? And I was waiting for Coca-Cola or Geico or, you know, See's Candy or something. I knew all his investments. And he said, it's what you teach. And I said, well, I teach a lot of things. He goes, I went and I learned how to run my own mind, but more importantly, I learned how to communicate. He went to Dale Carnegie. He said, it was the best investment in my life. Mm. You wouldn't know who I was otherwise, because all this mind knowledge wouldn't have any value unless I could communicate it, right? Mm. So I think the most important thing I learned early on was that we're all equal as souls, but we are not equal in the marketplace. And what makes you superior in the marketplace is by investing in yourself and developing skills. Buffett talks about no one can tax those skills.
Yes.
Right? You get a bigger return on that than anything else. So investing in your own personal and professional development is the essence of what my life has always been. So I was fortunate enough to know that. I think if I would have understood compounding earlier on, like I just explained to you, you know, I would have been a billionaire at a much, you know, earlier stage of life, obviously, but I have no complaints. Yeah. I started with absolutely nothing. I had nobody in my family that had been successful financially. We had no money for food. One of the reasons I'm so proud that I just completed this last year, last February, I set a goal. I started feeding two families because I got fed when I was 11. We had no money and no food at Thanksgiving. And I remember it. So at 17, I fed two families, and then four, and then eight. Every year I kept doubling it. Got my little company involved, and then I had multiple companies. Now I have, you know, 114 companies. We do $7 billion in revenue. All my people Amazing. Are part of this. But I started getting to, I could feed 2 million people a year, and then 4 million, 2 million from the people I raised and 2 million from me. And then about 8 years ago, I was doing all these interviews with multi-billionaires. And while I'm having these interviews, I'm watching Congress cut food stamps. They call it the SNAP program now. And they cut it by almost $6 billion. It means that every family that actually needs food would have to give up a week's worth of food every month unless somebody like you and I steps in the private sector. So I called my offices and I said, you know, tell me how many people we fed? Because I never kept track of it. And they said it was 42 million people. And I was like, I had no idea. I was like, wow. Man, I'm grateful I've been able to do that. That made me proud. And then I started thinking, what if I could feed 42 million people I've done my whole life in 1 year? What if I could do 100 million a year? What if I could do 100 million over 10 years and provide 1 billion meals? I just did that. I did it in 8 years. And now I'm doing a 100 billion meal challenge because unfortunately, because of the war in Ukraine and because of no access to fertilizer, because Russia has been shut down as well. It's been a major piece. There are 21 countries on the verge of famine that nobody talks about. Wow. So I'm working with, I'm fortunate enough to partner with Governor Beasley, who's the gentleman who won the Nobel Prize several years ago, the World Food Program. And we're partnering together to do 100 billion meals. I figured if I could do 1 billion meals, and when I started, I wasn't a billionaire, 100 million a year for 10 years, we need to find just 99 other people like me. And I'm proud to tell you, in the last year and a half, we are up to 60 billion meals, which we're real close. We're going to kick it over the edge. We get to 100 billion meals. That provides the foundation while we're doing the sustainable long-term solutions. But one of the things I wish I would have known is the power of tithing.
Okay.
And I don't mean in terms of religion. I interviewed decades ago Sir John Templeton, who started with nothing and became the first billionaire investor. And when I was asking him, I said, what does it take to truly be wealthy? And he goes, he said the same phrase as that Warren Buffett said when I was talking about the other piece. He goes, it's something you teach. I said, well, I teach a lot of things. Which part? He goes, gratitude. He goes, if you got $1 billion and you're not grateful, you're poor. If you got nothing, but you're grateful for your health, for your family, your kids, you're rich. And I said, well, what do you think the secret to wealth is? And he said, I think I've never met anybody in 20 years, 30 years of investing who tithe for at least 10 years. And he said, tithing doesn't have to be church. It just means a percentage, ideally 10% of what you earn, given away to something you believe in. It can be movements, directions, nonprofits, anything. It doesn't have to be a church, or it could be a church. And he goes, I've never met anybody who's done that for a decade or more who has not become incredibly wealthy. And I've been doing that for about 19 years. And I mean, the rewards I get psychologically, spiritually, and emotionally are so much greater than the financial rewards. But I obviously have the financial rewards as well. And you get to a point in your life, hopefully, you know, successful enough externally that you're successful enough internally that you have this part of you that wants to give. And I hope you don't wait. Because a friend of mine the other day, Mike Keyes is his name. I've known him for 43 years or something like that. And I knew him when I had nothing. And he was on a plane the other day and somebody was reading my book, Life Force, sitting beside him. And so he likes to see what people think without knowing that he's related to me, a friend of mine. And he says, what do you think of that book? They go, oh, it's so great. They went on and on. You're like, there's these breakthroughs in health and stem cells. And the guy was really excited. And he goes, what do you think of the guy who wrote it? He goes, that Tony Robbins guy. Wow, he seems like such a really good guy, nice guy. He even donated all the profits in this book, which, yes, by the way, I've done, yes, for all my financial books. 100% of the money from this book also goes, wow, to Feeding America. And he goes, but, you know, of course, he's wealthy, so it's easy. And Mike smiled really big. And he goes, really? He goes, what if I told you I've known that guy for 43 years since he was 16 years old? What if I told you I knew him when he had no money and he was still donating, yeah, to the guy in the corner? That he was getting money to be able to donate, which is true. And the guy said, yeah, he was feeding people at that stage at 19 years old too. And the guy's like, really? And yeah. So I always tell people, if you don't take a dime out of a dollar, I promise you, you're not going to take 10 million out of 100 million and give it away, or 100 million out of a billion. So start where you are. And the value of that is it teaches your brain there's more than enough. Mm. That you don't have to live in this world of scarcity. Otherwise, you're going to have a lot of money and still live in scarcity. So I wish I knew compounding. I wish I knew that component. But I'm grateful early on I figured out the value of investing in myself first.
Right.
Because everything has come from that. Because of the growth I've had something to give. Mm. You have nothing to give if you don't grow.
So much, talk about gratitude, so much gratitude for everything that you have taught me selfishly about personal development, about feeding yourself first, about, you know, giving to others, about investment, about the health and longevity. I'm a student, but also thank you for giving to the success community. I can't tell you how excited we are to do more with you, here in 2024. How about that? But it's going to be a phenomenal year. I want to make sure everybody knows that your book goes on sale.
It's on sale now. All the money from the book, 100% of it feeds Feeding America. So while you're helping yourself, you're helping other people, but I hope you'll be blessed by it. And it won't just show you private equity. It shows you private credit. You know, in private credit, give you an idea, people, 2021, only a few years ago, junk bonds went crazy, right? They call them high yield bonds. They're junk bonds because, right, they're very low quality. And then that crashed. And the reason they did it was no one could get a return on bonds that was reasonable. And you get 3.9% on these risky million of bonds. I was doing private credit and getting at that point 9%, to give you an idea. And the private credit environment is much stronger now since all these banks have gone under, these smaller banks. What's happened is the banks over the years have tightened and tightened, and businesses need money. So they go to these private equity groups that have private credit. They're very disciplined. Their average loss is 1% of the loans going. Any bank would die for that. So it's safer. And we were getting 9% then. Well, guess what? When interest rates rose, if you had a fixed rate mortgage, you didn't care. Mm. But if you had something that was a floating rate, yep, you cared.
That's right.
When it went to 8%, holy cow. Well, when it comes to loans that are denominated by private credit to businesses, those businesses are on floating rates. It's natural. So they were borrowing money at 5% and 6% back then. And all of a sudden, guess what? We're getting 11, 12, 13% now on the same loans without any additional capital. So our returns have exploded.
Right.
And so I have private credit. Okay. I have private real estate. I have, of course, private equity. And one other thing I want people to know is in the book is a lot of people have a dream that I was able to only make a few years ago, which is to own a piece of a significant sports team. I helped to build and create with some partners the LAFC football club in Los Angeles, and I had fun helping design the colors and being a part of that, and just the excitement of building a stadium. It was amazing. But it was a year of a microscope in every part of my body to get through that. You cannot believe what they put you through before you're qualified to be an owner, on top of the money. Well, some new rules have happened in the last 24 months that are amazing. There's only a few firms in the world able to do this. But they allow you now to buy a small piece of multiple companies.
What?
And the returns, they're not correlated to the stock market.
Okay.
So let's say inflation happens. Well, guess what? Your hot dog costs a lot more. People pay $10, $12 for a hot dog. I don't eat hot dogs. I don't know what the cost is. But they'll pay for whatever for a beer there. And you have a fan base. They're called fanatics. That's where the word fan comes from. You have a legal monopoly. Nobody else can compete with you. Then what else do you got? Well, on top of all that, they're no longer just putting butts in seats. They're media corporations. And what's really cool about it is you're an owner. You're a part of the team. You get to see what's going on, be a part of that. But also from a pure investment, once again, you know, it doesn't matter what stock market's doing. That doesn't affect this. And, you know, I like Michael Jordan. I think he invested $285 million to buy a piece of his team. He just sold it 12 years later and kept part of it still. but sold the majority of his stake for $3 billion. In the last 10 years, the stock market's done a little bit better. It's been almost 11%. But it's been 18% if you did across just the balance of the Major League Baseball, NBA, hockey, and soccer. So, and it's fun. So I own a piece of the Red Sox, I own a piece of the Golden State Warriors, the LA Dodgers, the Pittsburgh Penguins, and all those. So I have this fun experience of life while I'm doing part of a business that they own real estate, they own media, they have, they're much more sophisticated companies than ever before. So it's another one of those 8 to 12 that you can invest in that most people have no clue about.
I can only think of, you know, 100 people who would be interested in investing. You know, major sports fans. You said the Red Sox. My father would die. Like, it might just have to be something I do on his behalf, which
that
is incredible.
Would be very cool.
So, love the opportunity to sit with you.
Thank you.
Thank you for everything you've done. I ask one final question, if you don't mind, and it is Tony Robbins. How do you define success?
To me, it's living life on your terms. You know, everybody has a different idea. Is that, you know, for some people, that's writing a novel. For somebody else, it's having three beautiful children. Somebody else, it's a garden. It's being able to sing or do music or build a business. It's like, I think it's a personal thing, but it's living life on your terms, you know, having an extraordinary quality of life, but it also is having a meaningful life, which means finding something to serve more than yourself.
Yeah.
Because there's only so much you'll do for you. You don't need that much, you know? But if you have, whether it be your family or whether it be your company or a mission you have or something, a nonprofit or something that just matters to you most, that's what'll give you energy for a lifetime. That's what I find today. It's like the goals that drive me today, I got to a point in my life, it's like, I don't need more things, homes, cars, airplanes, all that stuff. Like, what is it that will really make me want to continue to grow? And it's like, I'm gonna feed 1 billion people. And then it was, I'm, you know, I have my own private plane. Obviously, it's a big plane that uses a lot of carbon. And so I was like, okay, how much is it? And it's about 3,000 trees a year. So I'm going to plant 100 million trees. So I planted 71 million already. And not just planted the trees, but did it in a way where we're helping these farmers who are making $1 a day to make $12 a day, which doesn't sound like much, but it makes them wealthy in their community versus starving. And it's like, I went to India, I saw these kids that were, you know, had all these sicknesses and dying. It was waterborne sicknesses. It's like, I want to provide fresh water for 1 million people a day. We're up to 250,000 people a day, every day in India. And so it's like, and none of them know me. I'm not doing it for accolades. It's just, I know that I've done that. I think one of the most horrific things in the world is trafficking and children being trafficked. So my wife and I committed, and I even went on some tours with some people undercover to see the insanity of it and rescue these kids. But now we're up to 36,000 children. You know, I want to free 100,000 children. Originally wanted 30,000, but we've passed it now. But those are the goals that excite me. So you got to find what's going to juice you. So success is a meaningful life. It doesn't mean it's happy every moment. It isn't always happy every moment, but it's meaningful. It feels like your life matters, whether it be your family or a mission or hopefully both, and where you feel like you're living life on your terms. That's the way I look at it.
Love that. And you certainly have lived a very meaningful life. Thank you for...
I hope I got a lot more time ahead of me.
Oh, man. Thank you for this. Thank you for your knowledge. Thank you for sharing with us. Thank you for helping us be better human beings. And thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for your kindness. It was really nice meeting you.
It was really nice to meet you, too.